Thank you for inviting me to speak this evening. I came to teach a class at in the creative writing course, which I just worked for a single day yesterday with a bunch of people, and we had a really wonderful time. I always expect to find teaching really grueling and awful, and I always panic in advance and think of reasons why I wish I hadn't said I'd do it. But then as soon as I walk into the room and we get started, there's something happens in those classes that's exciting and wonderful. So it was a really good one yesterday. Now, I was asked what I wanted to speak about tonight, and I said I wanted to speak about the spare room. And the person who was asking me said, well, can you give us a title for the talk? And I just said, oh, death and friendship. And then I saw it written on a piece of paper, and it looked so portentous, I wasn't quite sure if I could live up to it. But I'll have a go. So I thought I might, just so we can get used to each other, I thought I might read the first little section of the book, which sort of sets the themes of it, I suppose, in a way. Can everyone hear me? First, in my spare room, I swiveled the bed onto a north-south axis. Isn't that supposed to align the sleeper with the planet's positive energy flow or something? She would think so. I made it up nicely with a fresh fitted sheet, the pale pink one, since she had a famous feel for colour, and pink is flattering even to skin that has turned yellowish. Would she like a flat pillow or a bulky one? Was she allergic to feathers, or even as a vegetarian opposed to their use? I would offer choice. I rounded up all the extra pillows in the house, slid each one into a crisply ironed slip, and plumped them in a row across the head of the bed. I pulled up the wooden Venetian and threw open the window. Air drifted in, smelling leafy, though you couldn't see a leaf unless you forced open the wire screen and leaned right out. She'd been staying for months with her niece, Iris, on the 8th floor of an Art Deco apartment block in Elizabeth Bay, whose windows, I imagined, pointed due north over a canopy of massive Sydney figs toward the blue field of the harbour. The immediate view from my spare room, until I could get some geraniums happening in a window box, was of the old grey paling fence that separated my place from my daughter Eva's. The sash window faced east, though, and the light bouncing off the weatherboard side of Eva's house kept the room bright until well into the afternoon. Also, it was late October, which in Melbourne is supposed to be spring. I was worrying about her feet. The floor of her room was bare timber except for a worn keelum full of rips. What if she snagged one of her long, elegant toes in it? What if she fell? Slippers were among the things she didn't bother with, along with suitcases, bras, deodorants and irons. I rolled up the dangerous keelum and threw it into the back shed. Then I drove over to a shop opposite Piedamonte's supermarket, where my friend Peggy, who knows about these things, said they sold tribal rugs. Straight away I spotted a pretty one, blossoms of watery green and salmon twining on a mushroom ground. The bloke told me it was Iranian, vegetable dyed. I chose it because it was faded. She would hate me to buy anything specially, to make a fuss. Would she want to look at herself? It was months since I'd last laid eyes on her. All I knew was from our emails. Every time the news sounded bad under her chirpy chatter, I would suggest flying up to Sydney. But she put me off. She was going out to dinner and couldn't change the date, or there wouldn't be a bed for me, or she didn't want me to waste my money. She might take it the wrong way if her room lacked a mirror. Behind the bookshelf in my workroom, I found one I'd bought in an Asian import shop at Berkeley Square and never used. A tall, narrow, unframed rectangle of glass, its back still equipped, top and bottom, with strips of double-sided adhesive tape. I selected a discreet spot for it, just inside the door of her room, and pressed it firmly against the plaster. On the bedside table, I fanned out some chord charts to have a crack at on our ukuleles. I arranged the reading lamp on a gracious angle and placed beside it a mug full of nameless greenery that I'd found near the back shed. Then I went along the corridor to my room at the front of the house, and lay on the bed with my boots on. It was 4 o'clock in the afternoon. What woke me 10 minutes later was a horrible two-stage smash, so sickening, so total, that I thought someone had thrown a brick through the side window. I rushed out all trembly and ran along the hall. Nothing moved. The house was quiet. I must have dreamt it. But the edge of the old hall runner, halfway to the kitchen, was weirdly sparkling. I stepped over it and into the spare room. The mirror no longer existed. The wall was bare, and the Iranian rug was thick with the glitter of broken glass. I swept with a dustpan and brush. I beat with a millet broom. I hoovered in cunning, angled strokes. The fragments of mirror were mean-shaped and stubborn, some so minuscule they were only chips of light. They hid against the rug's scalp in the roots of its fur. I got down on my knees and picked them out with my fingernails. When the daylight faded and I had to stop, my sister Connie called me. A mirror broke in her room? I was silent. Then she said in a low, urgent voice, "Don't tell Nicola." Now, you can see in that opening that Nicola's not the only person in this story who has weird beliefs. It is very strange when you think about it to believe that a broken mirror brings whatever it is, 7 years bad luck. But that's the subtext of that section. But I'd like to get a certain matter out of the way first in speaking about this book, and that's the obsessive desire that some critics have had to nail this book as only an account of a real experience, and therefore that it's somehow illegitimate for me to have called it a novel. I'm aware that I tend to take a rather defensive tone when I'm talking about these things, but what the hell? I'm going to say this stuff anyway. I can't help feeling that all this sort of bristling and ruffling of feathers is a sort of a displacement activity, in that it's something for people to do instead of attending to what the book's actually about or wanting to talk about, which is death, dying and death. So the word novel on the cover, it's a flag that I'm running up the pole. And it means this is not memoir. It means this, the contract that I have with you, if you read this book, is not the one we'd agree on if the book were a memoir. The word novel is actually on the cover because it's telling you something. It's saying this is not journalism. It's supposed to be art. It wants to go in deeper than journalism. I've taken liberties. It's my prerogative, I think, to take all the liberties I need in order to make the book do what I want it to do. Now, this is the year 2010, and I'm wondering how many more centuries have to pass before people will acknowledge that this is what writers do. We grab hold of whatever's to hand, and we slave away to make something out of it that's going to bring us relief from the terrible anxiety of being alive in this world and knowing that we're going to die. In other words, I'm hoping that readers will trust me and want to follow my voice in this book. I'm hoping for readers who won't keep irritably dragging the book back to its imagined origins in real life, of which it has many. But that's not the point. I think that's a dead-end inquiry, actually, always to be trying to drag a book back to what you think its origins are. And I don't propose to account for myself as a journalist about this book. I intend to take a stand on this matter as an artist. Well, it's a book about friendship and about what the approach of death can do to a friendship. It's about the bad faith that can result from the unexpressed and perhaps inexpressible terror of death and what I've called the sick air of falsehood. Now, I'm going to read a passage from much later in the book, well, about halfway through, actually. And for those who haven't read the book, I'll just quickly sum up. It's about the narrator of the book is it's a first-person narration, and the narrator's called Helen. I'll explain that later if you force me to. it's about Helen and her friend Nicola, who are both women in their 60s, old hippies, basically. And Nicola, who lives in Sydney, she's got stage 4 cancer, and she's been through all the treatments that Western medicine can provide, and they haven't worked, and they've basically said to her, well, there's nothing more we can do. So what she's done is she's got on the internet or been recommended to a particular clinic in Melbourne, which is called the Theodore Institute. And this clinic is an alternative one, and she contacts the narrator Helen and says, listen, can I come down and stay with you for 3 weeks in Melbourne while I go to have these treatments at the Theodore Institute? So this has been an arrangement that they've made. And she arrives, and Helen's actually rather shocked by two things. Firstly, to see how extremely, extremely sick Nicola is, much sicker than she'd given Helen to understand. And secondly, the clinic, and Helen takes her in there on the first day, it turns out that the clinic is obviously shonky. There's a bunch of charlatans in there who are preying on people with terminal illness and trying to, they're charging them $3,000 a week for certain ludicrous treatments. I should say here that this book is not an attack on alternative medicine as such. And I've made a point throughout the book of trying to be a little bit flexible on this matter. But it does interest me greatly how it's possible for, how there are people in the world who are either deluded or criminal who convince people who are terrified of dying that if they give them a lot of money and breathe some ozone in and have some a lot of vitamin C, that they can be saved from dying. I actually feel get very hot under the collar when I think about this. And so the whole book is a kind of hot under the collar book. And I'll get to that in a minute too. But I want to read a little section where Helen takes Nicola to visit her friend Peggy. We drove to Fitzroy. When Peggy, chic and smooth-haired, opened her front door, Nicola leapt through it and straight into the kitchen, grinning wildly, spraying compliments and exclamations in her poshest accent. It was a tremendous performance of being alive. It scraped on my nerves. A bowl of walnuts stood on the sideboard. I grabbed a couple and cracked them in my palms. I ate the first few kernels, but the cracking was so gratifying that after I'd eaten enough, I kept going, trying to find each nut's weak point, grinding the hard shells against each other till they split. Now, I just need to tell you that when this book was published in America, the American editor got in touch with me and said, now listen, about this cracking the walnuts, she said, it's just not humanly possible to crack walnuts with your bare hands. And I said, don't be ridiculous, I do it every day. And she said, well, she said, my husband's a weightlifter. And I said to him, look, in this book, so this woman cracks walnuts in her bare hands, and she said, I can't do it. And he said, well, give me a couple of walnuts, I'll try. And he couldn't do it either. I think, is this right, Ray? They have different sort of shells in America?
But I have actually done that, so they just were inexperienced.
Well, I had to fight for that. She wanted me to take it out because she thought people wouldn't believe it. But no, leave it in, please. Right, so this scene, I should mention, introduces one of the main themes of the book, which is rage. So I'll now read it. When Nicola paused for breath, Peggy ushered us out into the garden. We sat under a roof of blossoming white roses whose petals sprinkled down onto the embroidered tablecloth. She served us pleasantly and with grace, biscuits and a cake, coffee and interesting kinds of tea. She and Nicola spoke with sighs and wry smiles about the difficulties of caring for their mothers, queenly dames in their 90s who were often balefully demanding. Mine, who had been small and sad and beaten, was already 5 years dead. I sat and listened. So, said Peggy at last, how's it all going over there? Well, Nicola began, leaning forward with a smile so glassy that it tinkled. It's all going brilliantly. Helen's a wonderfully severe matron. But we've had to get hold of some morphine the last few days. You see, at the Theodore Institute, which is marvellous, they give me a certain intravenous vitamin C treatment every second day. She was settling in. Irritated, I tipped my head back and took a proper look at the roses. Quite a few of them were already drying up and drooping. The pruning shears lay near me on the window ledge. I grabbed them and made a few furtive passes at the blossoms within reach. It does knock one around somewhat, Nicola went on, and I sometimes come home a wee bit under the weather. In actual fact, she comes home in rigors, you know, shuddering and sweating and unable to speak, but maintaining that there's nothing wrong with her. I felt my lips pursing. I stood up and moved away from the table, flexing the clippers as I went. An old wooden ladder was leaning against the shed wall. The little building was wreathed in the climbing roses, and every third flower was ready to be snipped. Of course, I know I'll always come through it unscathed. I know it's only the vitamin C savaging the tumours and driving them out. But, she said with a gay laugh, to my utter astonishment and to my shame for being so pathetically selfish, I was absolutely and totally unaware that to poor hell it was a horrendous spectacle. Clenching my teeth, I mounted the first three rungs and attacked the upper layers of the plant. Poor hell. The blossoms fell from my blades in a steady shower of white. The brick paving was strewn with them. So late last night, she went on, I rang my divine niece Iris, who I'd been staying with in Sydney for the last 6 months, and asked her if she'd found the shivering scary. And she said, what are you talking about, woman? It's terrifying. I was shitting myself every time. You look as if you're about to die. Her voice rose and broke in a trill of social laughter. I forced the safety catch shut on the pruning shears and climbed down to the ground. Nicola moved along the bench to make room for me. Peggy filled my cup and pushed it across to me without meeting my eye. And so, said Nicola, swigging the dregs of her tea, we're going to ring the palliative care people tomorrow. I know we'll never need to call them out. I'm sure the treatment's shifting the cancer. Within 10 days I'll be fighting fit and on the mend. The palliative thing's just so hell won't feel completely alone and without backup. My poor old hell. Blood rushed into my face. Nicola's eyebrows shot up to her hairline. She bared her teeth at me and laughed again, a melodious, mocking gust of it from deep in her throat. It's the nights, I said in a strangled voice. The nights are long. Peggy glanced at me. Horrified sympathy passed along her eye beams. It weakened me. A huge wave of fatigue rinsed me from head to foot. I was afraid I would slide off the bench and measure my length among the cut roses. At the same time, a chain of metallic thoughts went clanking through my head. Like the first dropping of an anchor, death will not be denied. To try is grandiose. It drives madness into the soul. It leeches out virtue. It injects poison into friendship and makes a mockery of love. When you take on the care of a dying person, I've found, I should say that I've got a bit of form in this matter. I looked after my mother and I looked after my sister. My sister actually, we kept her at home until she died. So I have looked after quite a few people. But when you take on the care of a dying person, at the beginning, the first time, you entertain a certain fantasy of yourself, a rather narcissistic fantasy of yourself as this really admirable Florence Nightingale type of figure, you know, the person who sort of pads in and out of the room with the lamp at night, bringing comfort and being soothing. That was my fantasy with my friend. The physical labour was never the problem. The physical labour, I think, is the easiest part. The sheets, the washing, the bringing of, the thinking of delicious little morsels that will tempt an ailing person's appetite. And you see, in a sense, you see yourself as vertical and as the dying person as horizontal. In other words, you're the active one and they're passive. That's the fantasy. But what you learn is that the dying person isn't going to be a passive recipient of your magnificent generosity. She's going to fight you every inch of the way. It's a power struggle. This is something that I was amazed to find out. See, now I'm speaking about myself. And look, let's face it, this book is based on the three worst weeks of my life. It is based on personal experience, but as I said at the beginning, I feel that morally it's a novel because I changed many things in it. There are whole passages in it that I invented. There are many things I omitted, and it really isn't just a straightforward account of what really happened. So I feel that not to call it a novel would be actually a trick. It would be false. But so I think the person who's caring for someone dying, what you don't factor in, for example, is the sleep deprivation. You forget that when you have a baby, that stunned state that you're in where you just stagger from task to task and the days and nights blur into each other. And I was it was 30 plus years since I'd done that kind of work, and I'd forgotten sleep deprivation and what it can do. The other thing you don't know about in advance is the tremendous silent power struggle that can take place between the living and the dying when the chips are down. There's a clash of, especially when there's a clash of worldviews, which is what happened between the Helen in this story and Nicola. And Nicola was basically a flaky old hippie. You know, she's the sort of person who'd believe anything if it was said to her in a charming enough voice. Whereas the Helen, the kind of me character in the book, is a kind of bad-tempered skeptic, and with alarm bells that go off very loudly when people start talking about intravenous vitamin C. But there's also the dying person is angry to be dying. There's a kind of muffled resentment that the dying person can feel of the living one who's cheerfully running in and out and looking, you know, sort of dressed prettily and bringing in little sensitive snacks. And there's some... I remember one of the things I didn't put in the book was when I actually was at my friend's house. I was slaving away in the kitchen. I'd gone out and bought attractive food because she was a vegetarian, and I'd preparing these delicious meals. And I remember one day I was cooking away and rattling the pots and pans, and I'd got to the point where I was putting the food on plates, trying to make it look nice. And she was in the next room, and she said to me, and my friend was the most charming, lovely, and sweet-natured person, but she said to me, "Don't I get any of that?" And I couldn't believe that these words had come from this person's mouth, that it was completely out of character. But I understood that we were, on some level, we were raging at each other. But she wanted to keep a lid on it. She had to keep a lid on it. She couldn't acknowledge that she was going to die. And she almost felt, I think, that if she kept a terrible, cheerful smile on her face, this would keep death at bay, and that the smile was one of the worst parts of this story. I think there's that the living person also, I mean the person who's vertical, is also raging against the dying person, because the dying person is enacting the fate, the future fate of the person who's supposedly in control of the situation. It's a very deep and very complex knot, I think, that exists between people in that situation. Now, I mentioned before that there's a lot of anger in this book. Someone I know well, who shall remain nameless, wrote to me and said, "I haven't read your book, but I've been told that it's a blast of unexamined anger, so I don't think I will." And I was actually furious at that. I thought, well, for obvious reasons. But anyway, I won't enter into that small byway. But the anger in the book, this is one reason why I gave the narrator my own name, because I knew that the anger in the book was, to a certain degree, ugly, that it wasn't... I disappointed myself enormously in the way I dealt with my friend when she was dying. I thought that I was going to be fabulous. I thought I was going to be sweet-tempered, and I didn't expect this rage and struggle that there would be. And so when she died and when I felt that I needed to write the book, I didn't want anyone to think I'd made up that anger. I wanted to sort of own it and own up to it, and because I suppose I really wanted to have a conversation with the rest of the world about anger. I felt that I couldn't be the only one who'd been angry, but at the same time I did feel that I was, and I felt ashamed. I felt desperately ashamed of it. But I also had an urge when I was writing the book to sweeten it all the time. I felt this almost every day. The book, it didn't take me long to write. It sort of came pouring out, but it took me, well, pouring is 6 months. I don't know if you call that pouring, but I had this, I could feel it in myself always, this urge to sweeten and almost sentimentalise the story, to invent moments or to stress moments of sweetness between us, of affection. And I spent a lot of time kind of jackhammering that stuff out of it. I thought of it as barnacles in a way, that they were stopping them. I needed the story to move forward at great speed because it was contained within... I needed the story to be contained within a three-week period. And these little excrescences of sentimentality kept popping out on the surface of it. I desperately wanted to soften and sweeten it, but And I knew, but I could tell that that my reason for doing that was to make myself look better. I kept thinking, when people read this, they're going to think badly of me. They're going to think, what a bitch. She is so hard. And I thought, okay, well, if that's the way I'm going to look that way, because I actually want to say these things. So when the book came out, I found that strangers would come up to me in the supermarket or in the street, mostly women, but not all. They'd come up to me and they'd just touch me on the arm, and I'd turn around and they'd say, thanks for writing about the anger. They went straight to the point. And these were all people who'd obviously been in a similar situation and knew the feeling. But I think people who hadn't been in that situation found the anger repugnant and unexamined was the word that people used. Well, this one particular person used. And I was struck by that, but I don't think it's unexamined. And one thing that I was happy about when the book came out was that I was invited to speak at unusual kinds of events. For example, there's a hospital the cancer hospital in Melbourne. It's called the Peter MacCallum Cancer Institute. And I got an invitation from them, from a social worker there who'd read the book, to come and speak there. And they had a lunchtime meeting, and I thought a couple of social workers and might turn up. But the place was packed. There were nurses, there were doctors, and they all wanted to talk about the desperate, helpless anger, and not just anger, but helplessness that people feel when they're trying to be useful to dying people. And I was flabbergasted by this. I imagined that in a place like the Peter MacCallum, they'd have a handle on it because they deal with it every day. But it seems that it's still a kind of taboo subject. One of my sisters was a so-called bereavement counsellor at that hospital. She's a nurse, but she worked. She's also trained as a counsellor. And she told me how often you'd walk into the room of a person who was obviously dying and their wife or husband would be standing there or sitting there by the bed, and she said she'd walk in and she said, I put my hand on the back of the person who was sitting by the bed, and what I felt was a rock-hard rigidity, as if an enormous, powerful feeling was being only just contained, and it wasn't just simple grief. But I think that anger in these situations is actually a form of grief. It's a form of terror, or sometimes it's a kind of a screen emotion. People sometimes can feel when something awful happens or people are frightened. Anger can be a sort of default emotion that people go to, because in a sense anger is an active kind of feeling. You know, it makes you want to go out there and smash things, and it's outward directed, whereas grief and sorrow are things that are perhaps there's no physical way that your body can kind of lose them or express them. I've tried to think about these things, and they're very painful and difficult things. But the other people who asked me to speak it was an outfit called Carers Australia that some of you might be familiar with. They asked me if I'd speak at their annual conference, and so I went along, and I thought, well, I'll just take a risk and I'll talk about this anger stuff, because maybe, I mean, these are people who have spent, people who've looked after a disabled child, for example, or a dying spouse, or somebody with a mental illness in their family that they've looked after for many, many years, not just for 3 weeks. So I rock up to this event, and I walked into the room. It was a room like this, and full of people who had that look of those who've been up against it for long periods of time. And you can tell that look. I had friends once who had a deeply autistic child, and I went with them once to the Steiner farm where this boy lived, and I was really struck by the faces of the parents who were going to visit their children there. Just a look of profound endurance and long-born suffering that deeply impressed me. And that's what these people were like at the carers meeting. And so I thought I'd talk about the anger, and I read a few little bits of the book that were about how angry I'd been. And I looked around as I was reading, and I could see that there was nobody there who was offended by what I was saying. People were looking at me with kindly expressions and as if they understood what I was talking about. And afterwards, a woman came up to me and she took me by the arm and said, "Listen, Helen, you must never be ashamed of that anger. We all feel it. Everyone in this room knows what that feeling is. So don't ever be ashamed of it." And that was a moment of enormous relief to me. Maybe women are even less supposed to be angry than men. I'm not sure. But it does seem a huge problem. But thinking about these things, I wonder what comfort there is. I wonder if people seek comfort in such a book. I always hope that truth will comfort people and free them. There's a moment in the book where Helen is so angry that she explodes in rage and shouts and brutally, she sort of almost brutalises her friend. But how are we going for time? I could read that out. How much time have we actually got? How long are you expecting this to go on for? Right, okay. Well, I don't want to sort of drone on forever, but I thought I'd just read this little scene because, this is a scene of great brutality, but it ends, so it cracks open some awful falseness, that's some bad faith that's developed between these two loving friends. So the thing is that Nicola continues to insist that the clinic is healing the cancer. She keeps saying by the middle of next week the cancer will be on the run. And it's so obviously not true that it's kind of grotesque. So on the previous night she's come home from the clinic in a terrible condition. In fact, such a terrible condition that the owner of the clinic, the shonky doctor, has had to drive her home. And Helen character has taken it right up to him in a pathetic and pointless way. I actually think this scene is quite funny. I'm not sure if other people think so, but meanwhile, Nicola keeps on pretending that nothing's wrong. So everyone goes to bed. The house is full of suppressed emotion. I had always thought that sorrow was the most exhausting of the emotions. Now I knew that it was anger. I lay galvanised on my bed for the rest of the night, seething and staring into the dark. Whenever I nodded off for a moment, the professor, that's the so-called professor who ran this fake clinic, the professor with his watery eyes and high colour slouched in and stood by the bed, grinning like a defrocked priest. At last the morning slid between the slats of the Venetian blinds. In the kitchen I filled the kettle and tore open the newspaper. Nicola came shuffling along the hall. Her head was high, the eyebrows arched, the smile huge and riveted on. She greeted me tunefully. "Good morning, darling friend." "Don't speak to me, Nicola," I muttered, turning away to the counter. "I can't even look at you, I'm so livid." "Ooh-ah," she trilled in a mocking girlish treble. "And don't give me that ooh-ah shit, don't you dare." Sweat broke out under my pyjama top. I glanced down at my chest and saw the ugly flush rising. She paused in the doorway in her nightie, holding the red wool shawl round her like a peasant. "What's wrong, Hel?" The crimson of her shawl was leaking into the air around her, staining it. "There's something I'd like to know," I said. "When are you going to get real?" Her mouth fell open. "What do you mean?" "Don't act dumb. I nurse you, I wait on you hand and foot, and then you turn around and laugh at me. You laughed at me." "What? What are you talking about?" "At Peggy's. You laughed at me for being scared at night. You made a joke of it. Poor old hell." "Oh, that," she said, "a week ago." She put out one hand to me, palm up, and drew in her chin. Her eyebrows formed an inverted V of patronising concern. "I'm so sorry, darling. I had no idea I'd offended you." She tilted her head, stretched her lips, and there it was again, plastered across her face like latex, the smile. The last of my self-control gave way. "Get that grin off your face. Get it off, or I'll wipe it off for you." It faded of its own accord. She took two steps backward, gaping at me. Why are you so angry? This house is full of anger. Can't you feel it? The rooms are stuffed with it, and a lot of it's got to be yours. Her mouth was half open, her cheeks hollow. Everything I looked at was blood-coloured. I couldn't stop. Everyone's angry. Everyone's scared, I shouted. You're angry and scared, but you won't admit it. You want to keep up this masquerade, so you dump your shit on me. I'm sick with it. I can't breathe. She cowered against the arm of the couch. That creep who brought you back here last night. Can't you see what a quack he is? He's taking you for a huge ride. Darling, she stammered, he's helping me. They're the only ones who are helping me. Oh, they're not helping you, that airhead Colette, the sappy fat guy, and the famous specialist. They're so creepy and repulsive. Why won't they do anything about your pain? They don't even seem to notice that you're suffering. Suffering, she said. Helen, there's a woman in there with only one leg. What about yesterday? They would have shoved you into a taxi if I hadn't kicked up a stink. They know what the vitamin C does to you. Why wasn't anyone monitoring you? One of the other patients was, said Nicola. She's a nurse. She was keeping an eye on me. And they charge you $2,000 a week for this, leaving it to another patient to look after you? She bridled. Janine's not just any old nurse, she's an intensive care nurse. Where was this rage stored in me? It gushed up like nausea. Can't you use your brains? Look what they're doing. Their treatments are bullshit, Nicola. They're ripping you off. They can't cure cancer. They can so. She raised her chin and glared at me. They can. If you can prove to me that that intravenous vitamin C cures cancer, I said, I'll give that sleazebag professor $1,000,000. Show me the evidence. There was a man up in Grafton, she said, a sculptor. He got better. That's not evidence. That's an anecdote. There's plenty more, she said, pages of it. I didn't bring it, but I've got it at home. Yeah, right, I said savagely, and it must be true because you got it off their website. My heart was beating so hard that black spots danced at the edge of my vision. Against the red shawl, Nicola's face had turned grey and sagged out of shape. Behind her, Iris, that's her niece who'd come to stay, appeared at the hall door. She paused on the threshold in her flannel pyjamas, a light presence, her arms folded across her chest. Shame choked me. I was a bully, caught in the act. I can't go on with this, I said in a high voice. I can't stand the falseness. It's making me sick. I'm going off my head. Nicola's shoulders slumped. Her neck came forward and her head bowed. Iris padded into the room. She sat on the arm of the couch beside Nicola, put one arm round her shoulders, then turned her face up to me and mouthed, with exaggerated lip movements, "Keep going." Shocked, I stared at her. She was holding Nicola upright but nodding at me, her eyes clear and steady, her mouth in a straight, determined line. I took a couple of big gulps of air and drove on. After that professor went home, Nicola, I said I wanted to come into your room and say to you, wake up. I was awake, she whispered. I wanted to say this, you're using that bloody clinic to distract yourself. Like an old tired dog, she heaved up her head. Don't say it, Hel. From what you have to do, she raised one palm, don't tell me. You've got to get ready. Her head drooped lower. Iris took hold of her in both arms. Nicola gave in and let her head tip sideways into the curve of the girl's shoulder. I could see her face distorting, her mouth clenching, the tears starting to run. The fight drained out of me. My limbs felt chalky and weak. We can't find you anymore, I said. We miss you. Where have you gone? She let out a thick sob. We can't bear what you're going through, I said. We can't bear to lose you. We want to look after you. You're so dear to us. But you crack hardy. You hold us away. We can't get to you. You fight us off and you make us feel silly for getting upset. She let Iris support her head while tears swarmed out of her eyes and dripped off her cheeks. Soon the breast of the girl's pyjama jacket was darkly soaked. Iris kept her grip, holding on with both arms, saying nothing, but every few seconds looking up at me and nodding. You wear us out. When you keep on being stoic, I said, it's like a horrible mask. We want to smash it. We want to find you. We can't bear the smile, darling, said Iris gently. You don't have to smile. Nicola wept on in her niece's embrace. Gab, that's the niece's boyfriend, Gab came to the door, looked in and crept away. But Iris held my gaze without a flicker, her sober face tilted up toward the counter behind which I stood, wringing the dry dishcloth in both hands. In a little while, Nicola stopped crying. She took a few quivering breaths and freed herself from Iris's arms. Iris reached for a clean tea towel and handed it to her. She dabbed at her eyes, folded it, and laid it on the counter. Then in a hoarse voice she said, "But see, all my life I've never wanted to bore people with the way I feel." We were silent. "No one wants to know about it if I'm sad or frightened." Again we said nothing. "I've learnt," she went on, "to shut up and present an optimistic face." She got off the couch arm and stood in her cotton nightie in the middle of the room. Light from the high window blurred her white hair. The shawl hung like two red curtains from her bony shoulders. "Anyway," she said, "that's what life has taught me." Iris leaned back against the couch and surveyed her with a soft face. "Bullshit, darling," she said. "I'm sorry, but that is so not the way to live." For a moment, no one moved or spoke. "You think your life's been wasted," I said. "It has." "I would like to dispute that." "So would I," said Iris. "Why do people love you?" I said. Nicola stood in the patch of light, wearing an almost comical expression of surprise. "You don't suppose it could be because of your character?" I said. "Like, for example, what a faithful friend you are, who's never been known to bear a grudge." She took a breath to make little of it, but I spoke over her. "Of your bottomless generosity, the way everything you touch becomes beautiful. What about how funny you are?" said Iris, warming to it. "And those play readings we used to have that were your idea, when we did She Stoops to Conquer and The Seagull. All the work you do for people and never ask for payment, reading their novels draft after draft, rewriting whole plays for people. Yes, and the way you listen when people talk. You even remember the details. When people are with you, they feel free. Don't you know that? You think this is waste?" There was another long silence. Iris crossed the room to the windows and raised the blinds. Rectangles of sunlight fell across the table. I opened the back door. Everything out there lay serene. The air that touched the cheek was fresh. Sun was warming the flat sides of things, the old brick paving. The fly curtain sprinkled its beads against the door frame and once more hung motionless. "I wish I still smoked," said Nicola. "I'd go out on that veranda and I'd bloody well roll myself one." She brushed through the beaded strands. Iris followed her. The kettle boiled and I brought the tray. We sat on the back step in a line and drank our tea. Someone said, "Isn't it a lovely morning?" And someone said, "Will we buy some fish for dinner?" Nicola rested her shoulder against mine. We looked each other in the eyes and away again, open and free. It was like being submerged to our chins in calm water. Our limbs were weightless, and so were our hearts. I looked at the clock. It was only 8:30. So, thanks. To me, in a sense, that's the central scene of the book, because it's the only time in the book where it's the characters have found it possible to crack through that terrible carapace of fear and express, love, really, a simple love and affection and reason why the friendship exists. And the sad thing is, though, that if it were a sentimental book, I mean, if I'd allowed myself to write sentimentally about this situation, I would have gone on from there. I would have had an urge to make that sort of blessed moment of openness be the note on which the book ended. But it was very tempting to do that, but it would have been false. It would have simplified, made everything too easy and too simple. So I had to sort of force myself to tell the rest of the story, which was terrible and full of pain. And that opening lasted about 15 hours. And after that, that carapace closed over or reformed. I think it's very terrifying for people to keep in mind constantly the fact that they're going to die. I know intellectually that I'm going to die, but I don't have to think about it every day. And I wonder sometimes, there's something a bit kind of totalitarian about my attitude, that, you know, everybody should be truthful all the time, and it obviously is not workable. But I always hope, I sort of believe in truth, if that's not unbearably naive to say. In this book, I'm not trying to make an absolute rule about how one should approach death. Plainly, there are people devise their own way of doing it. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes it only works for the dying person. Sometimes the people surrounding the dying person just have to keep mum. They have to keep their mouth shut so as not to crack the person's only way of enduring it. But I think I can bear witness to the distortion and wretchedness and a kind of agonising, misplaced effort that seems to be required in order to keep the truth hidden in these situations. There's the sheer loneliness of it. I think that's the worst part, that when somebody's cracking hardy like that, it makes it impossible for the people surrounding them to be real with them and to be open. So it kind of blocks off the love that could flow to them and the care. I'm going to read one last little passage. Let's see where it is. And this was one critic actually dismissed this scene as hocus pocus was the phrase used. But that's okay. He said some other nice things. But I call this scene the bike blessing scene. Somebody asks someone else for a blessing, and people go blessing equals God equals religion. No way. But that's I think it's a great shame to think that you would have to believe in God or an afterlife to bless somebody, or to ask for blessing. I've thought a lot about this matter of blessing, and I think in this scene there's the famous blessing in the Anglican prayer book anyway, that says something like this: may the Lord bless you and keep you and make his face to shine upon you. And I've thought about that a lot. I think that image of the face shining benevolently down on a person who's receiving blessing, it must surely be an image that comes from the earliest infancy, when the infant lies in the mother's arms or the father's arms, and the face of the adult looks at the child with complete, adoring, glorious, unconditional love. And you haven't had to do anything to deserve it. It's your right, and you're bathed in it, and you're contained in arms, the arms of safety and love, and you're adored and protected. I can't help feeling that that's where that image of blessing comes from. It's got nothing to do with religion. It's got to do with that earliest moment of our consciousness when we feel ourselves to be completely loved and approved of and contained. So I'm going to read this chapter. The character's name, this is the Helen character's sister's name is Lucy. 1 minute, 2, 4, so I'm just figuring out how long this is. So she's Helen has asked her sister to come and meet her. I came up the steps from Parliament Station and spotted Lucy cruising into Little Collins Street on her touring bike. It had big, reliable-looking panniers, and although the sun had not set, she had turned on one of those fast-blinking tail lights that illuminate the countryside for miles around. By the time I caught up with her, she was chaining the bike to a railing. Even as early as 6, we weren't the first customers at the Waiters Club. At the top of the wooden stairs, the joint was jumping. We ordered a couple of grilled flounder. The waitress brought wine in tumblers, and I began to gulp it down. Lucy saw from the look on my face that I was going to have to hog the conversation. I started with the enemas. Excuse me, I'm going to have to say some stuff about enemas, all right? It's not too gruesome. She's been told that she has to have a certain type of enema. And Lucy, by the way, is a nurse. If she's constipated, she said, an enema would move stuff along. That might relieve the pain in her belly. Yes, I said, I can see that. I'm the last person to have a problem with enemas. But coffee ones? Is coffee good for pain? And apparently the coffee has to be organic. Oh, For God's sake, said Lucy, it's going up her bum. Isn't instant good enough? Well, the boss of the clinic said it might reduce her reliance on morphine. What reliance? Is she shoveling it down? Bombed out of her brain? Queuing up first thing every morning at the doctor's? Oh, the crazed relief of dobbing, of disloyalty. We drank. We devoured the flat, pale fish. We polished off a salad and a pile of pancakes with lemon juice. And while we ate, I jabbered and Lucy split her sides. When the espresso arrived, we both calmed down and she began to analyse. I'm not surprised she laughed at your fear. Laughter like that's a sort of aggression, don't you think? You're the messenger with the bad news. She'd like to kill you for trying to carry it to her. She's fighting to keep it away, as if the message itself might kill her on the spot. So why did she choose me to stay with, I asked. She must trust you. You could take it as a compliment. I do, but there are clinics in Sydney where you can get those loony treatments. She's got heaps of friends up there, people from long before I met her. They'd have no trouble at all with ozone treatments and cupping, and they wouldn't keep pulling the rug out from under her the way I do. I'm scared she's going to turn me into a horrible, punitive mother. Lucy drained the tiny cup of coffee. When I worked with cancer patients years ago, she said, there was a man I used to sit with sometimes who was dying, but his family was pretending he was going to get better. He got attached to me. I think I liked him a lot. We used to have long existential conversations and I looked forward to them. On this particular day, it was past the end of my shift. I was tired. My feet were sore. I should have been out of there already. I just popped my head around his door on my way home and he hit me with it. I haven't got long to go, have I? He said. I wasn't prepared. I gave a pat answer. He turned away and said in a bored, dismissive tone, if you say so. I was upset. He'd given me an opening and I'd missed it. I went off feeling I'd failed him. But when I got home, I realised it didn't matter how pathetic my response was because there was a silent understanding between us. There was nobody else in that room, no one else in his life at that time who would say so. She smiled at me with her head on one side. I only just bit back the words, gee, you look like Mum. This was not considered a compliment between us. You mean, I said, you mean I have to say so and yet not say so? Maybe she's picked you for that exact job, said Lucy. Or maybe, consciously or otherwise, she's come to your house to die. I looked up in dismay. But I'm going away in December. I've paid for my ticket. Don't panic, said Lucy, undoing the clasp of her fat leather purse. No one can plan these things. Stage four can go on for years. But you don't really think that's why she came, do you? Well, it's a long way to come for a treatment, and she sounds as if she's getting quite a grip on you. That's when mothers get punitive, when their shift never ends. She laughed and pointed at my hands clasped on the tabletop. The knuckles were white. You're fighting, she said, to hold on to what's been precious in this friendship. But you don't want to go crazy or lose your grip on reality the way she has. It is a sort of madness, and it's quite common. We split the bill, piling notes and coins on the sticky tabletop, and thumped down the stairs into the lane. Do you ever go to communion? She asked as she unchained her bike from the car park railing. No, I can't find a church I can stand. I hate it when they're ponderous. Go to the Catholics then, she said. They really rip along. We laughed. A warm breeze puffed among the rubbish bins. Hey, Luce, can I ask you something? Would you bless me? She paused, with the straps of her helmet dangling beside her smooth cheeks. She started to take it off. Leave it on, I said. It makes you look official. Sometimes, she said, there's only one prayer to say. Lamb of God, you take away the sin of the world. I stood in front of her, listening and nodding. She put her palm against my forehead. Have mercy on us. Then she made a little twirl with her thumb, maybe the sign of the cross I couldn't see. May the Lord bless you and keep you, she said. Thank you. And make his face to shine upon you. She buckled up her helmet, flicked on her lights, kissed me on both cheeks and pedalled away in a westerly direction. Oh, well, how about we stop there? I mean, how about I stop there? That's I'm not sure if people want to ask me anything or attack me about anything I said. I'm very robust. Yeah. Oh, thanks. Thank you.